So, namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Can you let Bob get around behind the chair, Terry? You don't want your other chair? So we have been talking about the whole focus of Buddhism. This is a book that I have found very interesting to read. I don't know if you're familiar with this book, but it's quite wonderfully written. Teaching about what it is that Buddhism is really on about. It's not on about what a lot of people think about, you know, how to be good and how to avoid suffering. That we hear about a lot. My friend Betsy, who you know, said she was talking to someone she knows who's a Buddhist, and the person said to her, she's going through cancer treatment. The person said to her, "Well, you know, it's because it's your karma." So that's not Buddhism. That's belief in a fixed identity, and Buddhism doesn't go there. Buddhism says, how many selves have you been today? Have you been angry today? Have you been happy today? Have you been forgetful today? Have you been sort of just enjoying the summer today? Have you been sort of put off because you forgot something today? Each of them has a slightly different perspective, doesn't it? Can you identify any of those states? Did any of you have any of those states today?
Mm-hmm.
A couple of you did?
Mm-hmm. All of them.
Quite a few.
Yeah. And every one of them comes because of causes and conditions. Something, you know, interferes with what you want. Or you get too involved in what you're enjoying and you don't want to go away from it. Is this true? So all of those states come and go all the time, and each of them has a slightly different quality, don't they? Slightly different sense. You know that when you're in a good mood, you can look at something and really find it beautiful. When you're in a bad mood, you wonder why it was left there.
Mm.
Is that true?
Mm-hmm.
And we always think it's the same self. It's, well, I... We don't see that each one of those is a mind state. And that the mind states go marching throughout the day and the night. We don't see that. So we don't know that the desire we have for happiness is blocked so long as we're not, we could say that those mind states are riding us. It's the horse riding the rider, not the rider riding the horse. Does that make... You follow that, or should I say it another way? Okay. So when you can see that those mind states are actually arising because of causes and conditions, and they're not a real fixed identity, they change so fast, they're very fickle, aren't they? You can be upset 1 minute and then apologetic the next, can't you? I can. So, what is it that you would do to be able to see those mind states rather than be those mind states? That's what Buddhism is all about. First of all, is it possible to be aware of perception? Because where there's a particular emotion, the perception will be colored by it, won't it?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that what I was just saying? Mm-hmm. So if you can actually see the perception, there's a good chance that you'll have a choice about whether or not you want to be colored by that perception. isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So you know, some of you, I have you doing the meditation on the blue flower. And for most people who do the blue flower, they get bored with it really quickly. Say within the first 5 seconds, perhaps. If they're exceptionally good meditators. 2 seconds if they're me. And then you're watching it, and then your mind thinks, oh, this isn't so hard to do. Well, this reminds me of those flowers my aunt planted in her garden, and I remember them were something immediate, and something, some other thing other than just meditating on the blue flower comes up like that. And to be able to see that state and name it as a mind state, and just imagine that it's a room full of cushions and you give it a cushion to sit on. You know, we're looking at the blue flower, and you just bring your mind back. Because a mistake people make over and over again in meditation is trying to force their way to something. Being frustrated and trying to force your way to something will never get you satisfaction. It's good for teaching you how to apologize, but it's not so good at satisfaction. Is that true? So when you recognize that, and you realize that you don't want to force everything else out, you want to ask your mind to show you the blue flower. You look at it for a minute, and then you close your eyes and see, you know. You know, if you've seen something out there, you can see it with your eyes closed, otherwise we wouldn't dream. There wouldn't be any visual dreams if the images weren't in our brain, would there? So you know that the mind state is something that's arising to interfere with what you're trying to do. That's the horse trying to ride the rider. Mm-hmm. So you just say, okay, you sit over there, let's look at this together. And at some point, you begin to be able to identify all the different mind states as they come into being, exist, and pass away. There are different schools of Buddhism, but according to the schools of Buddhism, one of the most commonly accepted numbers is that there's 50 different mind states. So if you got 50 cushions, that should probably do you in your imaginary shrine room. And you, so that you teach yourself to be able to see the mind states, know that they are not self, and invite them to join you. In the process of that, what you learn is that each one of those mind states has a power. Is that true? So say, what's the power of dislike? Have you ever disliked anything?
Mm-hmm.
And what happens when you dislike something?
Tremendous frustration.
And but what does your, what's your first body reaction?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's just the way you scratched your arm. I can't scratch. Focus. Focus?
Mm-hmm.
If you've got an itch, the focus goes there. It's just like that. So when you know that dislike is the power of focus, then, for example, and an example I use a lot with people, is if you're caught in a circumstance where there's dislike, you can say, oh, I've got really good focus now. And you can switch yourself. If you're talking to someone that you, who has the bad taste to not appreciate your wisdom and beauty and joy and whatever, and you can focus, you can feel the dislike arising, and you can change the dislike to focus. My favorite thing is focus on the color of their eyes. And okay, I know your eyes are blue, but can I see any other color in them? And start really taking that focus to look, and pretty soon you feel your heart soften because you're enjoying them. As soon as you do that, they change. So that's the power. So each one of these 50 mind states has a power, has a gift. And when we actually can see the mind states, we have a choice about how we use them. If we can't see the mind states, we don't have that choice. It's pretty straightforward, isn't it? So whatever else, all the meditations that I know, and I've had the good fortune of studying with many teachers, which I'm very grateful, they all are basically to teach you to be aware of what's coming up in the mind and passing. They do it many different ways, because each path is suitable for a particular type of person. But they're all pointing to the same place. They're saying, okay, so is there a God? Isn't there a God? That's interesting. But really, who is it that would perceive something as God or as not God? Can I perceive the perception, the bias that wants me to believe in a God, wants me to not believe in a God? So, what is mind? That's what it boils right down to, isn't it? What is mind? What is the nature of mind? And the Buddha introduced this whole topic by starting with a group of people who he had studied with, and who seemed to him to their way of practicing was not helpful to him. It didn't work for him. So he left them. They were starving themselves. They were going to cut desire by negating it. And when he left, they thought, well, you know, he was a fake anyway, and we're more spiritual than him. And then he realizes that these are the only people that he can see who have the strong aspiration for wisdom, that they would actually hear him if he could speak to them. Because he had learned something that they want to know. So he thought, well, I'll go to them. That was his third or fourth choice. He had chose other people, but one was dead, and, you know, various things that didn't happen, so... He went to them, and as he's coming closer, they recognize him, and they say, oh, let's just ignore him. He's a quitter. He's a, you know, we don't want to. But as he was coming closer, one of the people said, wait a minute, something's different about this guy. I think we should talk to him. And so he came even closer, and they said, so Gautama, what are you on about? And he said, don't call me Gautama, I'm a Buddha. I said, what does that mean? He said, I have discovered the path. There is dissatisfaction. It has a cause. That which is causal has an end. There is a way to achieve the end of dissatisfaction. I have achieved that end. Immediately on saying that, one of the beings awakened. Immediately on just saying that much, because their aspiration was that great. And they had been working long for a long number of years. And then it's like, okay, there is suffering. What is suffering? There are three kinds of suffering. Do you know what they are? This is the test ground.
Getting what you want.
Getting what you don't want.
Being separated from what you hold precious. Suffering of change.
Suffering of change is the third one. Second one is being conjoined with what is unpleasant. First one is being conjoined with what is unpleasant. Second one is going to sleep in the pleasant, and it's impermanent. And the third one is called just the suffering of change, because it's even more profoundly the change than the first two. So what are they? First one is being the suffering of suffering, as sometimes called, the suffering of actually having a really rotten time. Second one is the suffering of the impermanence of happiness. And the third one is more subtle. It's the suffering of change. and why that was. I don't believe based on, all of them are based on ignorance, but the third one is based on the most refined ignorance, where we don't see our mind states changing, even in latent forms from latent forms during the day. But we don't see them changing incrementally whenever something comes into existence and the next moment happens and what it was before has changed. You see that with a baby growing, don't you? Almost in half an hour you can see them change, can't you?
Mm-hmm.
And who they were before isn't who, but that's happening to all of us all the time. But we don't see that, do we? It's incredible, isn't it? But that would be one of the main causes of dissatisfactoriness, that we ignore the truth of change in its most blatant moments of like the different mind states. We actually believe that there is a fixed self, and we do not pay attention to how many selves we are during a day. Sometimes in one mood you like one kind of food, sometimes in another mood you like another kind of food. It can be that in your face, can't it? A food that you know your body doesn't eat, but sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm.
And another time is somebody offers it, oh no, I never eat that. That eye doesn't, but the other eye gobbles it down. Does this make sense to you? Any questions, answers, comments, or complaints? This is a summary.
But we do think of ourselves as individuals who have moods.
Yes, but we don't think of ourselves not as individuals, but a self made of a collection of individual moods.
Right. Yeah, we think of it
as one self.
Mm-hmm. That puts on different costumes. It puts on, wears different clothes, like.
Yeah, but there's an I whose I is in control.
Yeah.
But I is not in control. As soon as there's a cause and condition, then another I pops up. Is that true, Don?
Yes.
Give us an example. I drop something on the floor. Come on.
And I'm trying to get it, and somebody's in my way, and I won't get up fast enough for me to go and grab it.
So?
I get frustrated.
You get frustrated, but a minute before, it was fun looking for it.
Yeah.
And then the next moment, it's anger. And then the next one is, oh God, I don't want to get angry. Right? And each one of them is a mind state, isn't it? And we do it all the time, don't we? And you can't see them as mind states. You think there's an I. And then you're caught defending that I, rather than saying, oh, that's a stupid mind state. I don't want to use that. However, what is it good for? I want to be aware of it, but I don't want to. I don't want the horse to ride the rider. I want the rider to ride the horse.
But
the mind states are the power that move you.
But even describing it, it's like, I don't want the rider to ride the horse.
But there is the eye of perceiving the perception.
Mm-hmm.
We call that awareness. There is the neutral point of awareness. Feeling has five types. Two of them are physical.
Pleasure.
Pain! Physical.
Mm-hmm.
With those come mental, do it again, like, get away from me, you beast, dislike, and neutral. Looking at somebody's eyes, try to see the color. Suddenly you're switched off of the dislike and into something. I wonder how many colors they have in their eyes. As if it mattered. As if you really cared. Because it's neutral. And it opens you.
So is this neutral state considered to be
a choice? When the mind is neutral, you can perceive perception. You can perceive yourself being irritated. And you can perceive that you don't want to do that. It's called awareness in most schools of Buddhism. Yeah.
But then what is it that's aware? What I is aware?
Yeah, and that's the next question. You don't get to that until you've got the awareness.
Okay.
don't jump ahead because it won't make sense to you. Mm. It'll just be a glib blah, blah, blah. Mm. And that doesn't help. And we already have the answer before we're ready for the experience to the next ground. Then we just become know-it-alls. Snotty know-it-alls. Don't we?
Yeah.
And we walk around being experts. But our heart isn't open, we're not present. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And which do I want to be? I mean, I know I could do know-it-all. That's brilliant, mind, my dear.
But it doesn't satisfy.
It leaves something hungry. It doesn't matter how much adulation I get. It leaves something, it's never satisfying, is it?
Mm-hmm.
But to actually see somebody discover something that makes them more happy,
delicious.
Isn't that what you see when you see children playing and they suddenly learn how to roller skate? Mm-hmm. Doesn't your heart just go, whoa, yeah.
Yeah, that's good.
Just fills you right up, doesn't it? It's so delicious. It's called empathetic joy, or sympathetic joy, some people say. I like empathetic. It's that joy of seeing somebody get something. So when you're in the neutral mind state, you're more like that. You see the joy of at oneness.
Mm.
And remember those videos, it's a brain pattern, sympathetic mm-hmm. joy. That's one we're all born with. We like it. It's already built in. You know, as a human, pretty well everything you ever want to awaken is already built in. All you gotta do is just decide you'd like to see whether it's possible to perceive perception. That's the first and the hardest stage. To be able to perceive perception. When you can actually watch who it is that is watching, you have choice. When you have choice, you can decide to turn the wheel of suffering to the wheel of that which transcends suffering. Get the wheel to spin the other way, rather than on and on, coming into being, existing, passing away, at one moment, they call it. And it is. I am certainly not a full-on awakened being, but according to my teacher, I had a taste of it. So, I don't know whether I believe him or not. It depends on the being. But there's something that I've tasted. That makes joy of seeing others open to themselves with love. That gives me more pleasure than anything else. I don't know. And you know that in yourselves too. Don't you? Do you? Yeah. I thought you did. Is that completely unsatisfying for you?
It's the language that gets in the way.
Okay, can you?
Because we use the word I to describe what an I is not.
We use the word I to describe all the different mind states. Do you want to open the doors? The cat might come in. Would that bother anybody? I think if you open the door, it makes more breeze.
The language of using I to describe what an I is not. I'm just like, what? It's actually like a koan.
It is like a koan, and that's what koans are on about.
Yeah.
Koans are a question that it's impossible to answer intellectually. So you have to go into a state of being to get an answer. Because the I is relative, always, subject-object. I know this. I like that. I saw you. It's always relative. Subject-object verb. It's the relative truth. It's very useful. If there is an experience that transcends subject-object duality, and we all have that experience, but most of all, we don't pull on it every day because we don't recognize it.
And how could you recognize it? Because it can't be a subject-object if it's an experience like that.
Because it is an experience of totality. You know, you've had moments of a holy state.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't forget to say nice day or stuff like that. And that's those states, do you? But it transcends the subject-object duality, doesn't it?
That's what I don't think I understand, how it can transcend subject-object if there's a subject because, that knows.
No, because there's an awareness of totality, an awareness of wellness. And there's an awareness of wellness that doesn't have to wipe out the relative truth. The relative truth is like scratchings on the surface of a beautiful ice pond. So that we're always focusing on the scratches and interpreting.
Mm-hmm.
The absolute truth is the recognition of the quality of ice. And the scratches can be there or not, but it doesn't change the quality of ice. They're not opposites. It's when we only focus on the scratches. You're this scratch, you're that scratch, that object is a scratch. That we're caught in subject-object duality.
Like the train thing. When you're on one side of the track and the train's going through and you just sort of
focus on the spaces
on
in
the
between
spaces
the cars.
Yeah.
And the cars can still go by, and you're still aware of them, but it's the space that you're aware of. And it doesn't interfere with the other.
Right.
That's why I give you that.
Yeah.
You got it.
I got it. After a while.
Trains go right by, not far from where I live, and it's free. So sometimes when people are on retreat, I send them to stand opposite the tracks, but in a field, sort of. And then just when the train goes by, just try to see the space in between each car and just keep your focus on the space. And it's like this. It's very neat.
And
it's nice to be able to use the trains to teach meditation.
Because it put it like you're trying, you're trying really hard.
And then you have to relax.
Yeah.
And it's just
and
there.
And it just flips.
Yeah. Exactly. Mm. And then you see space differently everywhere for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yeah.
Is that adequately sufficed? Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Okay, so this is still a recap. I've got half an hour left. If I get to what I was going to. Maybe I won't. Whatever. Let me know if I get boring. Now let us turn to the Buddha's teaching on the Four Noble Truths. The first question we might ask is why these truths are considered to be so fundamental, and why, in fact, the Buddha taught them at all. Isn't this a nice book? In order to answer this, we have to relate the Four Noble Truths to our own experience as individual human beings. It is a fact, a natural fact of life, that each one of us has an innate desire to seek happiness and to overcome suffering. You know that. All beings desire. This is something very instinctive, and there is no need to prove it. Happiness is something that we all aspire to achieve, And of course, we naturally have a right to fulfill that aspiration. In the same way, suffering is something everybody wishes to avoid. And we also have the right to try to overcome suffering. So if this aspiration to achieve happiness and overcome suffering is our natural state of being and our natural quest, the question is how we should go about fulfilling that aspiration. This leads us to the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, which provide an understanding of the relationship between two sets of events, causes and their effects. On the one side, we have suffering, but suffering does not come from nowhere. It arises as a result of its own causes and conditions. Doesn't it? Anybody have any question about that? You want me to explain it more? Okay. Say, for example, because I was just reminded of it earlier, you're hit by a gravel truck when you're 16. Because the three of you you and your two best friends had saved up enough money and got somebody to buy 6 bottles of beer, and one of your friends was, her mother was going away for the weekend, and it was Friday night, and she wouldn't be back until late Saturday night, and we had it all worked out. And so we had our packs and our homework and everything all with us in the last class, so we didn't have to go to our lockers. So when the bell rang, we ran out of the school as fast as we could, and the first person got to the end of the block, and the light was red for her to cross, but the bus was just crossing on a green light, and the light was just changing from red to green to orange, and she's pressing the button like that, and it just starts turning green, and she runs across the street, and the second one runs across the street, and I come running. I'm the third, I'm the slowest of the runners, and I don't look because there's a hedge there, and I see my two friends, and the first one is already getting on the bus, and the second one's halfway there. And I run out into the street, right? Very straightforward. Except, there's this guy who is a lovely man, has a family, drives a truck. He realizes he has to get the address, and he reaches for the piece of paper. He sees the green light is fine. The piece of paper falls. He just bends down just as the light turns orange, and it pushes, and he grabs for it. He steps back up, and already I'm hit. Did he mean it? Why did he have that job? How come he was in that lane? Did I look? No, the hedge was in the way. I just watched my friends. Did the bus driver know? You know, how many circumstances come in? Was it raining? Was it snowing? What about the other drivers? Did any of them honk? You know? Do you understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's so complicated. Why did I want to have that bottle of beer with this? You know? I didn't even like beer.
But it was the thing we were going to do.
I don't think they liked it either, but we were going to do it.
You can blame the mother, but why did she go away on Saturday? You wouldn't have had a party.
Oh, I mean, my mother not seeing that it was happening. She had psychic power. She should have caught that one. What's wrong with her? And it, on and on. Yeah. You can go, you can find 1,000 causes and conditions. Why did somebody buy the beer for us? Yeah. What got the idea in the brain? And how did we grow up together to become good friends, the three of us? How come we came up with that plan? You know, like there's 1,000. How come when I was 3 years old I looked this way instead of that, and so that's why I like that girl? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's incremental. The causes and conditions are so vast. According to the Buddha, anybody who hasn't had an experience of absolute tries to find the cause for any action. Look on that. Because you can't think beyond subject logic. We always think in a line, don't we? And it's logical, isn't it? And we find the reasons that support the emotion that we have in the moment. If I think I'm a total loss and I'm stupid and why didn't I say something different at tonight's class, I will pick all of the ways where I could have said something different, won't I? Do you ever do that? But will you look at the whole different selves that there were? No. or how the weather was that day, or what you were, you know, thinking about the business taxes, or day, you know, the deadline is already passed, or whatever, you know? Does that help? About that? So, an understanding of the relationship between two sets of events, causes and their effects. It doesn't say cause and effect. Causes and their effects. On one side, we have suffering, but suffering does not come from nowhere. It arises as a result of its own causes and conditions. On the other side, we have happiness, which also arises from its own particular set of causes and conditions. When we speak of happiness in Buddhism, the understanding is not confined to a state of feeling. Certainly, cessation, the total cessation of suffering, is not a state of feeling. That state of absolute spaciousness is not a state of feeling. It's neutral in one way, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's wide open. The total cessation of suffering is not a state of feeling, and yet we could say that cessation is the highest form of happiness, because it is, by definition, complete freedom from suffering. In that state of blissfulness, a mosquito could be biting you, and it would be, oh, take the blood. Or, it's not suffering. Here again, cessation or true happiness does not come into being from nowhere or without any cause. This is a subtle point, of course, because from the Buddhist perspective, cessation is not a conditioned event, so it cannot be said to be actually produced or caused by anything. However, the actualization or attainment of cessation does depend on the path and on the individual's effort. That is, you have to decide that you want to perceive the perceiver. That's the path. You want to be able to see the mind states and what their emotion is that's driving them. You want to ride the horse rather than the horse riding you. You don't want to be blind. Is that straightforward? You cannot attain cessation without making an effort. In this sense, we can therefore say that the path that leads to cessation is the cause of cessation.
Mm-hmm.
So they say the cause and the path are the same in some schools.
Mm-hmm.
Nice, eh? The teaching on the Four Noble Truths clearly distinguished two sets of causes and effects, those causes which produce suffering and those which produce happiness. By showing us how to distinguish these in our own lives, the teachings aim at nothing less than to enable us to fulfill our deepest aspiration, to be happy and to overcome suffering. Once we have realized that this is why Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, we might go on to ask ourselves the reasons for their specific sequence. Why are the Four Noble Truths taught in a particular order? Starting with suffering, continuing with the origin of suffering, and so on. On this point, we should understand that the order in which the Four Noble Truths are taught has nothing to do with the order in which things arise in reality. Rather, it is related to the way an individual should go about practicing the path and attain realization based on that practice. So first is, in order to practice the path, you have to be aware that there is dissatisfactoriness. And then be aware that dissatisfactory is. A friend of mine just finished doing a retreat with a meditation teacher, and she had such a good time. But she had to go somewhere the morning after the retreat ended, and she had already decided she'd leave 3 days early to give herself. But she had such a good time that she didn't do that. And so she waited, and then she left, and she was so happy. It was such a good retreat. And she packed really hurriedly, and then she got in the car and drove with some people that she doesn't get along with very well. And went to this event, which she wasn't looking forward to. Guess what happened? She crashed. Because the blissfulness that she was hiding in broke And then everything was wrong. And there was no escape. Because she was clinging to what she preferred and putting away what she didn't want to look at. Don't we do that?
Mm-hmm.
Don't we do that a lot, actually? And then secretly, we argue about it, don't we?
I shouldn't have done that. Well, but yeah, they are. But I shouldn't have. Oh, yeah, but they are.
Right? Any of you do that? Not the only one? Good, thank you. Whew, feel much better. So, is that good for that much?
Mm-hmm.
Can I go a little bit ahead now? Have I sort of given a good summary of what I've talked about so far?
Mm-hmm.
That's good, because we have 15 minutes left. The Sanskrit word for ignorance, which is the cause of all suffering, trying to ignore. And the most profound ignorance is the ignoring that there is no fixed identity. The Sanskrit word for ignorance or confusion is avidya, which literally means not knowing. And you've seen yourself choose to not know things, haven't you? We all do that sometimes, don't we? There are several interpretations of what is meant by avidya according to the different philosophical schools and their various views of the fundamental Buddhist doctrine of an anatman, or no self. However, the general meaning that is common to all the schools is an understanding that there lies a fundamental ignorance at the root of our existence. That's a very interesting statement, isn't it? The reason for this is quite simple. We all know from personal experience that what we deeply aspire to gain is happiness, and what we try to avoid is suffering. Yet our actions and our behavior only lead to more suffering and not to the lasting joy and happiness that we seek. This must surely mean that we are operating within the framework of ignorance. You really want something, but you keep not getting it. There must be something that you're not doing right. Is that good? Okay. This is how we experience the fundamental confusion at the root of our life. One way to reflect on the nature of dukkha, or suffering, according to dissatisfiedness, is what it actually means. According to the traditional Buddhist teachings, is to reflect on the sufferings endured in each of the six realms of the samsaric world system. These include hell realms, animal realm of pretas, hungry ghosts, and so on. For some people, such reflections may spur them to deepen their quest for freedom from suffering. However, for many other people, including myself, I think I'll read that again. However, for many other people, including myself, says His Holiness the Dalai Lama, however, for many other people, including myself, it can be more effective to reflect on our own human suffering. I have had so many people tell me how they don't want to hear about the hell realms. I don't even try to say to them, well, they're all just states of mind that you see if you do. If you pay it, you perceive perception. I don't even try that anymore. Although Buddhism teaches that human life is one of the most positive of all forms of life, since human beings have the potential to gain perfect enlightenment, it is not always that joyful. We've noticed that too, haven't we? We are subject to the unavoidable sufferings of birth, death, aging, and sickness. In addition, when one reflects on the fact that life is conditioned and dominated by confusion and the delusory emotions and thoughts to which confusion gives rise, then for someone like myself, it seems much more effective to recognize this than to think about the sufferings of other realms. As I mentioned before, the Buddhist scriptures describe the castle process through which ignorance gives rise to volitional acts, which in turn give rise to birth in one of the samsaric worlds and so on, as the 12 links of the chain of dependent origination.
on this, Buddha made three observations. He said that because there is this, that ensues. Because this came into being, that came into being. Because there is fundamental ignorance, volitional acts come into being. Because we don't know the door is locked, we keep trying to open it, the volitional act. Because there is fundamental ignorance, we keep trying for something because we ignore that it's not working. When commenting upon these three statements, a Sangha explains in the Compendium of Knowledge that three conditions are necessary for anything to arise. And I think an understanding of these would be useful here. Because there is this that ensues. Asanda explained that the significance of the first statement is that all phenomena come into being because they have causes. One could say there is an infinite causal chain. It is not as if there is a first cause or a beginning point in time from which everything arose. Asanda referred to that observation as the condition of the existence of a cause. Because this came into being, that came into being. When commenting on the second statement, Asanga introduced what he called the condition of impermanence. The meaning of this is that the mere fact that something exists is not sufficient for it to produce an effect. For something to have the potential to produce an effect, it must itself be subject to causation. In other words, it must come into being itself as a result of other causes. Hence we have an infinity of causes. So mere existence alone does not give rise to consequences. A cause should not only exist, it should also be impermanent and subject to cessation. The nanoseconds of every action, like you're born, or there's an egg and a sperm and an energy coming to being. 1 second later, that state is no longer there, because the next state, and 1 second, 1 nanosecond. Causes are continuously coming into being and then dissolving because the effect takes over coming into being. Is that good? Mm-hmm. Because this came into being, that came into being. Because there is fundamental ignorance, volitional acts come into being. Asanga's comment on this mentions a further qualification that is needed for a cause to produce an effect, which he calls the condition of potentiality. The idea is that it is not sufficient for a cause to exist and to be impermanent for it to produce a particular result. It is not the case that everything can produce everything or anything. There must be some kind of natural correlation between a cause and its effect. For example, because the nature of our life is suffering, we desire happiness. Yet out of ignorance, we create more suffering for ourselves. And this is because suffering is the root of our life. The result we obtain thus correlates with this cause. Now that's a little bit complex. Or is it okay?
You could explain it more something.
I think about suffering being the root of our life.
Because there is the suffering of suffering, dukkha dukkata. There is the suffering of impermanence. When you have something you like, it's impermanent. Mm-hmm. And there is the suffering of change.
So suffering is caused by suffering is caused by suffering. If you try to trace it back, not specifics.
Suffering is what?
Caused by suffering. The cause of suffering is suffering.
Is ignorance, yeah, which is a suffering.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what causes ignorance? Like
desire.
And what causes desire?
Contact, feeling, tasting, touching, smelling, desire.
So what causes?
Good. And then grasping. And then, yes, that's the whole, that's what the whole six realms, the 12 interdependence
so
is about.
So,
Exactly, depending on the suffering arises mind-body. It's like nama rupa, just very basically. There's suffering, there's like a awareness of that and a body that's feeling it. And then then comes sensing and then contact and so forth. So each of them is a very specific, I didn't remember your order, the 16 stages of the 12 stages of interdependence.
So, and these are like a chain that are all...
They're a chain, and each one causes the next, and the last one, and birth, death is the last one. And birth, death creates ignorance and ignorance. So like from moment to moment, there are various ways of translating that. Some schools like to put that as being over a 3-lifetime period. Other schools say that's ridiculous, that it's occurring in a minuscule amount, moment by moment, all the time, and every moment there's a rebirth of a self.
And that's the horse? That process is the horse that you were talking about?
Yeah.
That's riding you, or you're riding you? Like you use the analogy of... whether the horse is riding you or you're riding the horse?
Yeah.
Is that the horse?
Yeah, that wheel that keeps moving and moving and moving. But without... They say in the Tibetan tradition, they say consciousness, which has no legs, rides winds, which have no eyes. Winds are energy with the horse. They draw it sometimes. The consciousness, which has no legs, rides wind. So whatever wind is blowing, consciousness will blow to it. Isn't that true? And then the next wind happens and blows to that one. But consciousness has the power, with the eyes, to guide the winds. And that's what we have to learn how to do. Because otherwise, the wheel just keeps turning.
Consciousness is a wind?
Consciousness, yeah, is awareness is a quality of consciousness. Consciousness is like English is so hard for this, my darling, because in Buddhism there are like 5 different words for consciousness, but in English we got like brain. Awareness, but like none of them quite differentiate in a certain way. You know, we don't have the vocabulary.
Is it that feeling of like when you have awareness, you can see mind states arising?
Yeah.
The passing away, so you're aware of that.
Is that one quality? Yeah, but that's consciousness. But if a wind blows that drags the consciousness, it was sometimes the consciousness will go with any wind, even though it has the power to guide the wind.
Like if there's
that's
a
called ignorance.
Hmm? All of a sudden there's a backfire on the street and you go.
Yeah. Yeah, like that.
Like that.
Is that okay?
Yes. I guess I just really want to get it, but I need to give it time to...
It is, yeah. And I think the most important way to get it is just to keep trying to see the mind state that's trying to get it. Because there's some hunger in that, isn't there? Yeah. And who is the I that wants to get it? You know, maybe you've already got it. Mm-hmm. Maybe trying to get it is stopping you from getting it. You've already got it. If it is the ice with the scratches on it, you already have it. So maybe it's opening to it rather than... Is that possible?
So when you're talking about the analogy of watching a movie and looking at the screen rather than the movie that's playing on the screen...
Remember I've been saying that for what, 20
years?
Years
and years. Yeah.
Next time you go to a movie, when it's a really good movie, every once in a while just shift your eyesight and try to be aware of the screen on which the movie is playing.
Yeah. Look at the clarity, which allows the mind states to manifest. It's no different than watching the space. Because the space has clarity to it. One way is clarity, and the other way is emptiness, spaciousness. See the clarity with emptiness, see the emptiness with clarity. See the clarity with emptiness, see the emptiness with clarity. And then one moment, clarity and emptiness. And then the car goes by. Mm-hmm. Any other questions, answers, comments, or comments? Yes, sir.
So that's what the koan does, is your mind just gets tired of chasing after the no answer.
Eventually.
And the questioning mind is an opening in itself.
That's right.
And once the answer just gets tired and goes away, the opening's there.
Yeah.
And at that, and it breaks.
Yeah.
It breaks the craving because there's no contact to be made.
Yeah, and so it's similar to the blue flower, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The blue flower, you get tired of all, you know, you name them all, and you can actually recognize the mind states, and you're actually just playing around with that image, right? It's very similar. The blue flower is a great koan. It's a Tibetan way of doing a koan. It's brilliant. Is that good? Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? What'd you find?
About a little bug I'd like to catch if we take it outside. There's a water bottle on the table.
Don't squeeze it.
I'm not squeezing.
It's crawled off the Kleenexes now and it's running through her arm. By the time she gets to the door, it'll be about her armpit. No, sis.
She's like up in the middle of the neck and in the bra.
So is that satisfactory for tonight? Mm-hmm. I thought we'd go over this for a few weekends. Because it's not simple.
No.
Does that suit you? Mm-hmm. Go over it different ways and use different analogies. And so it may be called a simple path, but it's hard to get past our sense of a fixed identity, isn't it? Like an eye, who's going to get it? It's hard. It takes a lot of persistence and courage. And if we have time, maybe we'll. If you get this book, I'm sure you can get this book free.
What is it called?
It's called the Paticca-Samuppada, which is the Pali name for dependent origination. And there's a website there that I think you could probably go on and order copies of it. It's another well-known scholar of the Theravada school, and it gives you a slightly different slant. But I like looking at things from different schools because that's my training. You know.
So these two books, I find them very nice to go back and forth between, just to, you know, make the question a little more simple and joyful. Because that's important, isn't it? Joyfulness in Dharma. That must be why bad jokes are so important. You're back to the bug prawn. You're
prawn.
We were wrong. So you notice this beautiful gold light in your hearts, and it goes tinkling up to your shoulder blades and down to your toe bones. And you don't close your eyes because you know if you do, I'll throw my teeth at you. And it goes down your arms and out your back and out your front. It just moves through this whole room, this beautiful light. It's got this really beautiful quality to it. And it just goes through the walls and it just goes through the neighborhood. It goes right through all of Edmonton. It spreads right through down, up, above, below, front, behind, right, left, four quarters. It moves out everywhere. Wherever there is suffering due to ignorance of body, speech, or mind, just for a moment it's just temporarily assuaged. And you think whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is no suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings. So there is us. Thank you for your great compassion. Thank you.